You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. Where are you going?
Daniel, very engaged. Hey, we've got him in person now, but he's looking at his phone.
Well, I'm a bit worried about my train. We've got to get a train soon, but we've got plenty of time, don't worry.
That's nice. Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're kind of at the gateway to France, aren't we? We're at St Pancras, and the trains go straight, well, the Eurostar goes straight out of here and goes straight to Paris, where this morning the 2018 Tour de France route was officially unveiled. I was very pleased to note that it tallied exactly with the route that I'd been sent by a mole a couple of weeks ago. So having spent many of the recent years saying how I dislike all the leaks and rumours in the lead up to the Tour de France route, it's like spoiling Christmas by opening all your presents early. This morning was really flat for me because I already knew the route, sadly.
I also like the way you made it sound like we were connected somehow to events in Paris today.
We're connected by a train track.
Yeah, by sitting in a station from which a train leaves to... Yeah.
Well, a few years ago, we did go to the presentation in Paris, didn't we? And we meant to record the podcast there, put it off, and ended up recording it after we'd returned back to London.
Back in this very spot.
Exactly.
Pretty much. Yeah, we did. we're going to mainly talk about the Tour de France route for 2018 in this podcast. I think Daniel's just still researching all the climbs and so on. You know, very, very diligent.
He is our mountain man.
Yeah, yeah. Do we go to the Dolomites this year?
No, we don't.
You had to think about that. we're also going to hear from Chris Froome, because I was in Monaco last week before the route was announced, obviously, speaking to him. What's interesting is he clearly didn't know what it was. He knew as much as any of us. He thought there was going to be a time trial around Lake Annecy. Oh, it's in Lionel.
I could have told you that wasn't going to happen.
You could have told him what it was. But anyway, because I think a lot of us assume that the riders kind of are tipped off, or that they're not just surprised while sitting there in the auditorium, but that's clearly the case.
I think in recent years there's been more kind of leaks and misdirection, I think, because there was a lot of speculation, for example, that Alpe d'Huez would be attacked from a different direction using one of the back roads. That turns out not to be the case. They'll be using the famous 21 hairpin climb. So while a few things were reported mostly by local French newspapers, isn't it, who kind of, they get the information from local dignitaries and what have you, and end up piecing together the route in advance. But this year a few of the things were kept quite well under wraps.
Erroneous.
Yeah.
Shall we do a news roundup, Lionel, before we crack on with the route?
Well, it's very brief this week. The presidential tour of Turkey was the big world tour race, although it feels a bit strange to call it a world tour race because only four world tour teams actually took part, and they dominated it. Sam Bennett, the Irish sprinter riding for Bora Hansgrohe, won the first three stages and stage five. Diego Ulissi of UAE Team Emirates won stage four, and that set up his overall win. And then Edward Turns won the last stage. And one more World Tour race to go. That's the Tour of Guangxi in China. Thanks to a couple of listeners who emailed correcting my pronunciation of Guangxi last week. I said Guangxi. It's not a J sound, it's a sh sound.
We have our colleague from the Vuelta, Fran Reyes, going there.
Is it? It's going to be cracking.
There. Yeah.
I honestly think it's going to be cracking.
Well, he's promised to report back for us. He's going to get
the
some
landscape
stuff there.
There in the southern part of China with the casts, K-A-R-S-T. I don't know if cast is a kind of rock or is it the actual formations themselves, the form of the formations. Anyway, these big conical mountains that region of China is famous for.
Well, I think we're all scarred by the Tour of Beijing. This could be quite different.
Indeed.
Something to watch. Sorry, Lionel, I'll do you
finish. That's all right. Another couple of bits of news. Jan Bakelants, who had that terrible crash at the Il Lombardia a couple of weekends ago, he is out of hospital. after having an operation on his spine. It will be a long road to recovery for him, but he is fortunately he's out of hospital. And a big bit of transfer news today. Fabio Aru is leaving Astana to join UAE Team Emirates, where he will share the GC leadership duties with Ireland's Dan Martin. Interesting move.
Yeah, we kind of expected it, didn't we? Maybe running out of options, Fabio Aru, but we expect him to lead the team at the Giro, do we, Daniel, and Dan Martin at the Tour?
Very much so. I think there is going to be no confusion or no friction between Dan Martin and Fabio Aru, because they have been signed, both of them, on those respective promises that Aru is going to do the Giro and Martin the Tour.
Okay. So the Tour, the presentation of the route is always very... they do it well, don't they? It's a good show.
I've never been.
Well, I mean, just even watch it on TV.
I've never watched it either. I just wait for the route.
Yeah, it's quite.
I'm just sitting there with
Do you enjoy it, Lionel?
Kind of. There's a. I don't know whether it's the same as it was a couple of years ago when we went, but all the times I've been, there's a big kind of foyer outside the Palais de Congrès where everyone kind of gathers, and there's sort of a few drinks going around and canapes, and you find yourself bumping shoulders with sports directors and former riders and current riders sometimes, and journalists and kind of a lot of VIPs, I guess. I mean, not necessarily connected with the world of cycling, but they will be people from all of the different regions, towns and regions that are hosting the race. And then everyone filters into the Palais de Congrès and sits in. It's like a big cinema. You can get a translation if you want and listen to the all the formalities. And now it's on TV. That kind of mystique is broken down a bit. Everyone can join in and watch the race.
And notwithstanding that very good summing up, Lionel, I've never heard a good story about the tour presentation. Never heard a good story.
I quite enjoy the twinkle in Christian Prudhomme's eye as he stands there.
Oh, best quote ever from Christian Prudhomme at the tour presentation was a few years ago. What was it? It was something. Cycling is wasn't street. It was swag. Cycling, le vélo is swag. And no, I have got a good story. Correct me. I've got a good story because Christian Prudhomme, a few months later, informed me. I made some stupid mock-up on Twitter where I superimposed Christian Prudhomme's head on the Notorious B.I.G. as you do, with the caption, "Le vélo est swag." And Christian Prudhomme sent me a text message because his daughter had seen this meme. I don't think it went quite viral enough to constitute a meme. And he was most amused by it. He was most amused by it. So there you go. I said there were no good stories about the tour presentation. But I've just
that's an absolute cracker, yeah. That's certainly worth waiting for. How about the route? Was it worth waiting for?
Is it swag, Lionel? Well, is Le Vélo still swag?
I was just going to, on a more slightly more serious note, Christian Prudhomme began his presentation today by making quite a serious point about cycle safety and drivers, particularly respecting cyclists on the road. He made the point that, from the top professionals down to, families and children riding bikes on roads, we're all kind of vulnerable, I guess. And he held up a jersey with the, it's a French law. Is it a law that you must give cyclists a 1.5 metres of room when overtaking in a car?
I think it's a law, yeah.
It's certainly a campaign, yes. Isn't it?
Spain has done the most on this so far. Of all the sort of Western European nations, Spain has done the most on a kind of legal level.
It was interesting seeing the Tour de France, which is obviously the organiser of a sporting event, taking that line right at the start of the unveiling of their route, because I think they recognise that the next generation of cyclists, the next generation of Tour de France riders, they need to have safe roads to ride their bikes on.
Just on that, don't want to upset Prudy if he's listening, but on safety, the transfer, we'll go week by week, I think, aren't we, going through the route, but the transfer on the last, or the penultimate evening, back to Paris, which entails a very long drive for most people covering the race, is from the furthest point in metropolitan France or mainland France back to Paris. Not terribly safe, I don't think, at the end of 3 weeks.
That's a really good point. I think Lionel and I will be flying home rather than driving up to Paris as we did this year, bailing out early. But that is a good point. I mean, this is now an absolute this is dogma, isn't it, that the penultimate stage finishes somewhere in the Alps or the Pyrenees, and then there's this huge slog back to Paris. And it used to be a journey back to Paris. The tour, certainly the first few I did, you were winding your way back to the capital, and so Paris felt like a natural ending and continuation. Now it feels like something quite different, something bolted onto the end. And I think that's a bit
like
of a problem.
Like to see a tour not ending in Paris?
Yeah,
I would.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, my experience with other grand tours when they've not finished in capital cities or the city where they usually finish has been good generally. I've thought that, well, depending on to what extent that city embraces the race, but I have, well, for example, the 2014 Vuelta finished in Santiago de Compostela. It was a great success, I thought.
I'm sure the Tour de France will finish in Yorkshire one here. Gary Verity will be working
on it.
Could
have finished in Lourdes, couldn't they? Down there, way down there in the southwest. We all love Lourdes.
My goodness, I'm mindful that I have several things I complain about, Andorra being one. But of course, when I said Andorra was the worst place in Western Europe,
it's a toss-up,
I was completely wrong, because Lourdes is even much worse. It's so bad, it's not even in the... Well, I mean, it's not even on the same page.
But let's not dwell on the negatives, because we are looking forward to two rest days in Annecy and Carcassonne, two of the very nicest places in France. But you said we're going to go through it week by week, Daniel. So we start in the west of France in the Vendée. First tour I ever did, 2005, also started in the Vendée. And we no prologue, a road stage to begin with. And we kind of wind our way up to Brittany. Anything, I mean, there's a lot of coast there. There's some quite...
There's a lot of coast.
There's a lot of weather. There's a lot of weather there.
Big sea. Big ocean.
The biggest
yeah.
Sea.
Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. I'm trying to help you along here.
You're absolutely
just
right.
Just prompt you to say something interesting about these early stages, which are also quite climby.
Well, they are. Mark Cavendish has already said that it looks like, on paper, one of the hardest tours, possibly the hardest tour that he'll have done. And not a huge amount of opportunities for the sprinters. Perhaps the first couple of days will go their way. And then there's a team time trial in Cholet, which I think will be interesting rather than kind of pivotal. And then the hugging the coastline up to Sarzeau, from a logistical point of view, that it's quite remote getting out there, right onto the western coast there. And then the stage from Lorient to Quimper, which is stage 5, that looks like a really difficult day. Christian Prudhomme described it as being like an Ardennes classic but held in the west of France, and looking at the profile, that will be an interesting day, as will the finish at the Mur de Bretagne. And this year, unlike in 2011 and 2015, I think, when Cadel Evans won and Alexis Villermoz won on the top of the climb, they're actually going over it twice. So I think the tour organisers are realising that you can put in a cheeky little finish like the Mur de Bretagne, which is difficult, but everybody kind of waits and waits, don't they? The particularly the year Evans won, it was kind of like a GC rider sprint up to the finish, and perhaps having a little loop. Not only is it better for the spectators on the ground watching the race, because they get to see them come up the climb twice, but it could make the racing different as well. So you can see them over sort of a number of years reacting to how the riders tackle the stages and continuing to evolve and innovate.
Nibali lost time, didn't he, on that climb, even though they only went up it once in 2015. He was a defending champion, and we saw early on that year that he was probably not going to be able to defend his title. So, you know, these early climby stages they're not exactly the Alps or the Pyrenees, but they can be pretty challenging.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk later about whether or who this tour ultimately favours, climbers or time trials. I think who it really favours, we can already say looking at the first week, is the guys who are able to maintain their concentration and focus every single day, because there are going to be things, big things, dangerous things. There's going to be something to test them mentally, if not physically, every single day. And you know, riders like Thibaut Pinot, who has struggled with that in the past, on the first week he's had issues, whether it be due to wind or cobbles or so forth.
He suffered with wind, has he?
Right, yeah, he has. I think, yeah, in both senses. Well, Tom Dumoulin struggled with wind as well in the Giro. So, you know, I think Froome will look at those stages pretty confidently because in terms of racing ability, well, he certainly has the pedigree in terms of maintaining concentration. But in terms of being going into those stages aggressively as well and not on the defensive, not thinking, oh, I don't want to lose anything today, but thinking, right, we're going to actually take this race on and we're going to make it hard for everyone else. I think he'll be looking forward to that week. Others will not. You know, the Quintanas, the Pinos. Dumoulin is a bit of an unknown quantity in that kind of setting, I would say.
Of course, with eight riders in each team, the number of riders being reduced by one next year, that will, there'll be some nervousness, there'll be some caution perhaps. And I think by making those stages quite tricky and testing early on, particularly with the cobbled one to come at the end of the first phase of racing on the on stage nine before the rest day and the transfer down to the Alps, you know, there could be some, you know, teams could be eroded away a little bit in terms of their strength before the two big blocks of mountains. So, you know, the organisers there have made it challenging, made it not necessarily difficult to control, but the teams will have to decide whether or not to take control early on or whether to wait and save everybody's legs until the mountains.
And you said, Lionel, that the team time trial might not be that significant in terms of time gains or losses, but we've seen, unfortunately, we do see in team time trials teams crashing en masse and, you know, sometimes losing one, two riders and having other riders who are injured. And obviously that is an even bigger disadvantage when they've only got eight in total.
That's the thing. A lot of people made the point that, you know, Chris Froome won the tour this year with seven teammates after losing Geraint Thomas pretty early. The problem isn't so much eight riders, it's if you lose one and go down to seven, or if you lose two and go down to six, and then you really are at a disadvantage, I would say. I think, you know, the difference between eight and nine might not be so much, but the difference between eight and seven, the difference gets bigger. You know, losing one to seven is more significant than losing one to eight.
Yeah, and there are going to be some big decisions for team managers to make. In terms of obviously the composition of that eight, it almost becomes more important to get it right. And I don't think we're going to see any GC, anyone with any designs on a high position on GC coming in with riders who are looking for stages, looking to pursue any kind of personal ambitions. That the eight riders have to be completely devoted to their leader.
Well, on stage nine, the cobbled stage, the mini Paris-Roubaix, does this count as the first week or the second week? Because it's the last stage before the rest day, but it's the ninth day of racing. My OCD tendencies would say, although it's not 7 days, week one includes that second weekend.
Did you know that the 1990 Giro finished on a Wednesday? Do you know that?
Yeah. Where did that come from?
I've been wanting to get that in. Well, did you realise that?
This thing of the tour starting.
And that was to do with the World Cup as well. That was to do with the World Cup,
really.
Well, the World Cup final is on that Sunday, on July the 15th, the cobbled stage. The day before to Amiens, I have to mention that, because my in-laws live there. And Lionel, I think we'll be having another night.
Wow, when we were there last time, 2 years ago?
Yeah, two years ago.
Your father-in-law served us a goose from his garden for dinner. It was absolutely delicious.
It's around now. It's around about this time of year. He wanders into the garden. I imagine he wears gloves for the task.
Not to alienate any vegetarian or vegan listeners, yeah, Richard.
I'm sure vegetarians and vegans do understand how meat arrives on the table.
Anyway, it's around about this time of year, so yeah, maybe he's preparing our meals as we speak.
So will we be having Romain the goose, or Thibaut the goose, or Wawa the goose?
Thibaut's goose is cooked.
Do you know, it's a terrible, talking of gastronomy, it is an Epicurean things. It's a bad tour for wine. It's a bad tour for wine this year. Oh, we'll go on to that later.
Next year, even. Well, it's a good.
I think in Roubaix, do they not? They drink wine in.
Yeah, but we'll be leaving Roubaix.
In brown paper bags.
Yeah. Okay. We'll not be lingering in Roubaix for lots of reasons, but mainly because we've got a long transfer to Annecy that night. Stage does finish early, but that cobbled stage. I mean, we've dabbled with the cobbles in recent years. Why are you laughing at that?
Yes, we have. You're right.
We dabbled with the cobbles. This is a fully fledged cobbled stage, isn't it? 15 sections of pavé.
Nearly 22 kilometres.
Quite a shortish stage, 154 kilometres stage.
Well, there's 47 kilometres before the first section of cobble. So, I mean, you can imagine that being, you know, under an hour of absolutely breakneck racing, because some guys will be wanting to get in the break. The GC riders will be wanting to make sure, you know, they're in a good position coming to the first three sections of pavé, none of which are familiar to people who've watched Paris-Roubaix. But then after that, they have a number of sections. I think it's 10 sections of cobbles that have all been in this year's Paris-Roubaix. So although Mont-Jean-Pével, for example, it's a really difficult section in Paris-Roubaix, by the looks of it, they're using only 900 metres of it, not the full 3 kilometres. They're also avoiding the Carrefour de l'Arbre, but the rest of it is a full menu of Paris-Roubaix cobbles. And as you said, Rich, after kind of 2014 was great because the weather was bad, and Astana with Vincenzo Nibali and
Fuglsang
and Lars Bohm.
Lars Bohm was riding for Lotto at the time.
Of course he was, yeah.
But he joined Astana later.
Bohm won the stage, and it was Nibali who really laid the foundation for winning the Tour on that day, really. Of course, Chris Froome wasn't on the cobbles that day because he'd pulled out of the race before he even reached the cobblestones. But in recent years, you know, the Tour has kind of skirted with the cobbles. I think this is really testing for GC type riders.
I can imagine Christian Prudhomme and Thierry Gouvenet when they, I don't know what they, how they ultimately commit the Tour route to reality. I don't know whether they press save as on their PDF or press send or whatever. I can imagine them wincing and grimacing, clenching their buttocks as they did this thing. Is this too much? And no, they've gone ahead with it.
I think they do it in pencil first and then go over it in pen when they're happy. I don't know. Is that how they... I don't know. But I think you're right, Daniel. I mean, this is almost too much. It's one of those days where everyone will look forward to it. There'll be that suspicion that maybe people will be very, very cautious, but there will just be somebody who tries to put the cat among the pigeons, to use the old cliche, and there's nowhere to hide. That is, as I say, that is almost like the finale of Paris-Roubaix, and a lot of the GC riders won't know it. And the one thing that struck me was, I wonder whether we'll see some GC riders actually ride Paris-Roubaix this year and see what it's like, even if they're not up at the front.
Chris Froome was asked that question. That would be interesting to see. What interests me about it, I think, is that it comes pretty late. I mean, that second Sunday of the Tour is usually a kind of showpiece mountain stage. This year it was a stage to Chambéry. That second weekend is traditionally the first kind of overall skirmish. So it's fascinating to see that play out on cobbles rather than in the mountains, because I think that's a factor. We're quite deep into the race then. You know, things are patterns beginning to be established. It's late enough into the race that, you know, perhaps there'll be riders who look on it, GC riders look on it as an opportunity.
Do you not think, though, that ASO, having broadcast the whole of Paris-Roubaix this year, having enjoyed steadily upward viewing figures in the last few years, knowing that Paris-Roubaix always delivers, even an ordinary Paris-Roubaix is a watchable spectacle from start to finish, more or less. This is where cycling is going up against the World Cup, isn't it? And it's a great day of televised sport for people who like both cycling and football. And I think there may be sort of a reason or method to the madness here of scheduling it so that it's going to not compete with the World Cup for people's attention, but it's going to draw a huge audience. People are going to want to know what happens that day.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
My name's Ian Boswell, I'm a professional cyclist with Team Sky, and I'm fueled by Science and Sport.
Well, I think fueling depends on the climate, and we've spoken before about how you fuel for the heat and how important hydration is. In the cold, obviously hydration is important, but I think also the consumption of calories while riding is much higher in the cold because you're obviously having to heat your body. And I was actually talking to Dombrowski about it last night, and we were talking about winter training and just how much more you have to eat when the temperatures are cold. And then you also have to think about what products to bring on the ride, because if you're training in extreme cold conditions, you know, you get a bar that's been in your pocket for a couple hours and it's frozen solid, or, you know, you can't really bite through it. So, you know, and also, you know, especially through the winter months, you know, when you're trying to kind of build back muscle that you may have lost over the off season, the consumption of protein is really important. So that's why something like the SIS Whey 20 gel is so easy, because it's portable. And actually, I found that they're more delicious in winter time, because kind of like a creamy pocket of gel, and they go down really easy in the winter, but just a matter of staying fueled, you know, through the winter. Even though, you know, in the winter it's important to, a lot of riders are trying to lose weight, and so there's sometimes a mentality to cut down on calories, but it's so important to continue eating, you know, to lose weight, which sounds counterintuitive, but you know, you have to, a hot fire burns hotter than a fire with no fuel. So my fiance and I have just purchased a house in Peacham, Vermont, which is between nowhere and nowhere. But no, it's a beautiful place, and you know, there's tons of good riding, Nordic skiing in the winter, which I'll probably have to get a pair of skis for this winter to do a bit of training. But yeah, in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. If you speak to the old time Vermonters, they've mentioned, you know, in years past, like winters of, I guess, minus 30 Fahrenheit. So I don't know what that is in Celsius, but pretty darn cold, although the past several winters haven't been nearly that bad. I had one ride when I was living out in California, of all places, but I was up training in the Sierra Nevadas, and we got stuck in a snowstorm, and we had no food, and it was so cold that we got to the point where we had to, like, stop in someone's house, and we grabbed, like, some, in the U.S., you have, like, you know, when someone delivers the morning paper, they put it in, like, a kind of a plastic bag, and someone had a bunch of them, so we took four of them, put them over our feet, put them over our hands to try to get off this mountain. And it was freezing cold, but no food, so your hands can't work, so you couldn't even open a bar. And you just get to the point where you're just trying to, you just want to get home. And I think I went into the shower with all my kit on, because I was just so cold, I couldn't function to undo zippers and whatnot.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We heard there from Ian Boswell giving us some of his winter fueling tips. He, of course, is off to Team Katusha for next year. Maybe he'll be in the Tour de France team. Who knows? He's certainly bound to have more opportunities there, I think, than he's had at Team Sky. And I know he's looking forward to that, to the challenge. A reminder, you can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20. So, Lionel, it is... what is it? It's Sunday, July the 15th, and at 3 o'clock we're watching the finish of Stage 9 of the Tour de France, and then we're jumping in a car and driving down to Annecy. It's a long way.
I'm going to suggest that we stay and we stay and watch the World Cup final on television that Sunday evening and get the TGV down on the Monday, no?
With Scotland having not now qualified for the World Cup, my interest in it is pretty minimal. So, you know, because otherwise I'd be looking forward to watching Scotland in the World Cup final. But I don't know. It depends who's in the World Cup final. If, dare I say it, if England are in the World Cup final...
I'll not be watching England or anything.
I'd rather just I think, press on.
I think Ireland be France would be the dream result, no? Anyway.
Moving on. We're definitely into week two now. As I said earlier, Chris Froome thought there was going to be a time trial around Lake Annecy, which we had in 2009, didn't we? Alberto Contador didn't win that. Cancellara won it. But Contador more or less sealed his overall win in 2009 around Lake Annecy.
Contador did win it.
Did he win it?
Yeah, he did win it. Because we saw, you know, with me when Cancellara came into the press room, was in a casino, and we were sitting there, or I was sitting there with Bernie Eisel. I think I was doing an interview with Bernie Eisel, who, of course, good chums, good friends with Cancellara, and Cancellara came in and ordered a beer, slammed it down on the bar, and started ranting about Contador getting help from the motorbikes.
Ah, okay. That was also the time trouble where Mark Cavendish, did he not get off in the challenge? Some British
called
fans.
Him fat, he turned around. He turned around, went back up a hill.
And did he not almost eliminate himself in doing that?
Probably, yeah.
So lots of happy memories.
I rode that course that morning, and some Aussie fans were taking.
They didn't call you fat, did they?
They did actually. They basically mocked me, ran alongside me. Obviously, they didn't have to. They walked alongside me as I was going over the climb, mocking my weight.
That's terrible.
I had no comeback.
It was just warming up for Cavendish. Yeah. Anyway, we're definitely into week two now and into the mountains. Daniel, what can you tell us about these three stages in the Alps?
Well, we expected something different, a different twist on the Alpe d'Huez day, didn't we? We thought they'd be going up either the Col de Sarenne or from Villa Recula from the west. They're not, are they? They're going up the traditional way. The other stage, it's very noisy here suddenly, isn't it? The stage to La Rosière, that's never been used in the Tour de France before. It's been used in the Tour de l'Avenir. That's one of the three, I would say there are three real pure summit finishes in this Tour de France. That is one of them. We're also going over the Plateau de Glières. And on that climb, it's a very steep climb, about 5 kilometres, and there's a section of 2 kilometres which are not tarmac. Now, I don't know, Rich, I'm kind of ashamed of myself for not knowing this. I don't know when the last time the Tour de France went over a non-tarmac road was, but curiously, later in the race, you do know, you look as though you know.
Well, I mean, obviously, Pavé, that's an unpaved road, isn't it? The cobblestones are not tarmac. Just going back in time to week one, the big disappointment for me is that the stage that finishes at Mur de Bretagne doesn't go over the Ribinou, which are the farm tracks of Brittany, which the Trobriand race use. Lots of reports locally, and in fact, we made a short episode for Friends of the Podcast about the Trobriand, which we put out in April, and the organisers were absolutely convinced that ASO were looking at their territory to take the tour off-road and onto the farm tracks, but it hasn't happened this year. The ideal opportunity to do so, and also given that it's 40 years since Bernardino's first Tour de France victory, no visit to Ifinac either, his home village, a tiny little place, but you know, that's a little bit of a surprise. But we've gone back to Brittany. We should speed back down to the Alps.
Yeah,
now.
But what is interesting about the unpaved road is that it is a sign of how cycling is, you know, professional cycling is sort of reinventing itself and going back in time itself, going back to its roots and seeking out new dimensions to the racing. I think this is one of the most interesting things that's happened over the last 10 years or so, and a lot of it probably stems from the success of Strade Bianche, doesn't it?
Yeah, and another interesting innovation, Rich, we speculated this year about whether the spectacle of the very short 100 kilometre mountain stage in the Pyrenees would inspire ASO to include more stages like that in the future and be the face of the Tour de France's future. And this year they've doubled the dose, haven't they? Because there are two extremely short stages, one in the Alps, which is the stage to La Rosière, so 108 kilometres, also going over the Col du Pray that day, which is kind of the hipster way up the Corme de Roseland, a famous Tour de France climb, but they've never been up that way before. It's quite a hard climb, very nice climb, I've been up it. And so there's that short stage, and there's going to be another even shorter one, 65 kilometres in the Pyrenees. So quite a tough helping of alpine action, I would suggest.
And we reach the Pyrenees. I like the fact also that Pyrenees come second. I don't know why. You know, I just quite like this way of doing the tour. But we go via through the massive central, don't we, to Mond. It's difficult to know at this point exact routes, but we know start and finishes. But that, you know, that could be a tough stage. Again, in the past, 2010 in particular, when Sage finished at Mond, that was a really savage day, which almost did a lot of damage, didn't in the end, but those sorts of stages can be hard. And then the next day into Carcassonne, is that another sprinter stage, do we think?
No, it's not.
It's not.
There's a tough climb, about 1200 metre high climb in the finale there, and a descent into Carcassonne in the finish, so could see some general classification action that day as well. Of course, what we do know about the stage of Mond is that it will finish where the tour always finishes, in Mond, which is at the aerodrome, which really, I mean, I said there were only three pure summit finishes, mountaintop summit finishes, but that's a hard climb. It's about 4 kilometre climb, is it? Steep, and it's certainly somewhere where a pure climber can make up time.
when we get to Carcassonne, rest day in Carcassonne, of course, I am going to tackle Ellis Bacon's world record 3 cassoulets in 2 days. Quite a few years ago now, he had one for lunch, one for dinner, and then one for dinner the following night, and then had a big lie down. I'm going to try and beat that.
I think Ellis has woken up since then, hasn't he?
I'm going to try and beat that. 4 cassoulets in 2 days. I'm going to see if anyone wants to try and match me. Or share a car with me afterwards.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, Rafa. Their support has enabled us to bring you these podcasts throughout the year and to cover the Grand Tours as we have done. And obviously with the announcement of the Tour de France route, we're looking forward to next year as well. A few items of business. I mentioned I was in Monaco last week. We were doing a few things. I was with Orla Shinoui. We recorded an episode of the cycling podcast Femina with Tiffany Cromwell. That went out at the start of this week. Really fascinating chat with her. She's a Canyon SRAM rider, has been a professional for quite a number of years, and has a really interesting perspective on things. So it's a chat with Tiffany Cromwell. We also met with Chris Froome and Michelle Froome. Orla interviewed Michelle. It's something she'd wanted to do for a while. That will be our first Friends special of 2018, and details of how you become a friend of the podcast for 2018 will be revealed very soon. We did a few other things, met up with the Young Americans. That was a podcast we did a couple of years ago, Ian Boswell, Joe Dombrowski and Larry Warbass, and that will be a Friends special early in 2018 as well. Met up with them in Nice. We thought we'd play a little bit of Chris Froome, because we did chat a bit about the Tour de France next year and his quest to win a 5th title. So we thought we'd play a little excerpt from a much longer conversation that, as I say, will be released early in 2018. So here was Chris Froome last week talking about next year's Tour and his rivals.
The way I see it is each year it feels as if it's getting harder for me. It's getting more difficult. The level of my rivals is getting higher every year. I think people are learning to train better. More and more people are going to altitude every year, just pulling out all the stops to be at their absolute best. And I think that we've seen that in the racing over the last 12 months, that the races have been a lot closer. They have been a lot more hard fought, especially the Grand Tours, sometimes only being decided in the last couple of days. And I think next year will just be all that again, and even closer next year. I mean, obviously there's a prospect of Dumoulin coming into the picture, potentially to target the Tour de France. I think guys, strong guys also, but like Richie Porte, for example, who can time trial and climb extremely well. I think it all depends what kind of routes we'll get for the Grand Tours next year, and who's going to end up doing what at the end of the day. But I think whatever program I select, I know I'm going to have 3, 4, 5 guys who potentially could win the race.
Do you think about those guys a lot? I know that riders often say, "Oh no, I just think about myself. I focus on, you know, the thing I can control." But I get the impression you over the last couple of years in particular have shown yourself to be a racer. You know, really pressing home the advantage when you see an opportunity. You know, and that's pressing home the advantage over these rivals. I mean, over the last 2 or 3 years, do you find thoughts of Nairo Quintana, Vincenzo Nibali, these guys? Do you think about them a lot?
I do, and I, especially in my training, I think about how I'm going to tackle a race. I think it also changes how I tactically how we ride a race, how we ride a Grand Tour. I think in the Tour this year, for example, knowing that time trial in Marseille was at the end of the race, and I'd hedge most of my bets on being able to be better than the Romain Bardet and the pure climbers in that time trial. I didn't necessarily need to attack the climbs, whereas I think that changes depending on who I'm riding against.
Well, that leads obviously to the question of Tom Dumoulin. Do you wake up at night screaming thinking about Tom Dumoulin?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. In a way, I quite relish the challenge. I think it would be great to go head to head with him properly in a grand tour that I haven't really done yet. So I hope he decide to ride the tour as well.
But it's fair to say you haven't really met an opponent like him before. Somebody who you can't rely on getting that cushion over him in a time trial. That's going to change, surely, the way that you... We don't know the route yet. We'll know it next week. But that's going to change the way you approach the tour next year, isn't it?
I imagine it probably would. As you said, we need to see what the route looks like. But I think that probably would mean that I'd have to put a lot more focus into the climbs and know that, okay, I can hold my own in the time trials, but chances are, if I'm up against Tom Dumoulin, I'd need to make that time up in the mountains.
That was Chris Froome. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Still got a couple to come for this year. One on the team of the year, Team Sunweb. Daniel's beavering away on that. And we've got a lunch with Lionel, with a mystery guest. And the other bit of business for this week is to tell you that our event on the 20th of November that we've mentioned a couple of times, that's Monday the 20th of November, will be held at the Arts Theatre West End. That's on Great Newport Street in central London, right by Leicester Square.
Yeah, keep an eye on our Twitter handle @cycling_podcast, or even better, go to the website thecyclingpodcast.com and
if you're on our mailing list, you should also get a note.
Well, if you're not on the mailing list, sign up and get advance notice of when the tickets are going on sale. It should be any day now, but if you want to come along to the Art Theatre on November the 20th and see us and our friends in action.
We're a number of familiar voices. You'll be able to put faces to voices, and we'll have a celebrity guest from the world of professional cycling there as well. It should be a really good night, and we're looking forward to it. The three of us will be there, of course. Daniel,
what?
Week three of the Tour de France. So we wake up in Carcassonne on the morning of July the 24th, and we head to our favourite place, surely, on any tour, Luchon.
Oh.
Bagnères de Luchon.
Favourite?
Oh, it's a beautiful
spot. It's nice enough. I mean...
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's nice enough. Bottom of the Périssaud, isn't it? Pretty generic French town.
Generic French.
Well, it is. Anyway, I'm going to say something that's going to shock you. I'm going to say something that's really going to shock you. I think that the third week of this... Well, next year's Tour de France features the hardest climb the Tour de France has ever done. That's a climb that has never... been on the not the whole of this climb hasn't been on the route before. The Col de Porte on stage 17, so that's at the end, it's the summit finish of the very short stage we talked about, 65 kilometer stage. The Col de Porte is 2,215 meters high. It's 16 kilometers at 8.7%. Now, Alpe d'Huez is, I think, 13.4 kilometers at 8.1% or 8.2%. This is, in statistically, this is fairly similar to Mont Ventoux, but it is... slightly steeper, not quite as long, but slightly steeper, and it finishes higher, 2,215 meters, where altitude is going to be a factor. Also, if you're going to watch the Tour de France next year, it's an absolutely beautiful climb. You stand at the top, you can pretty much see down the whole climb. It's completely unobstructed views, totally exposed. Last point on this, it is really a continuation of the Plat d'Adet climb that everyone fondly remembers as the scene of George Hincapie's only victory in a mountain stage in the Tour de France in 2005.
Eyebrows were raised that day, weren't they? And that's the short stage, 65 kilometres. Also, it basically goes straight up the Périssaud, doesn't it, at the start, and then the Val d'Huron as well in the middle. So an awful lot of climbing packed into very little distance. This is doubling down on the short mountain stage model that we've seen. That's really since 2011, when Alpe d'Huez stage was only 100 110 or 120 kilometres, something like that. But it's not a brand new thing. Back in the 80s, they would have very short stages, but usually as part of a split day, they'd have two short stages. I'm thinking
they did it in 96 as well with Bjarne Riis.
not by design though. That
exciting
was
stage though.
It was 32 kilometres, wasn't it?
Was to it? Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, the snow closed the climb before it, didn't it? So they basically just raced along a valley a bit and then up Sestriere.
Also at the Giro they did it. One year Andy Hampson won a stage that was about 35 kilometres, pretty much straight up a climb.
Yeah, but no hiding place in a stage like that, is there? I mean, everyone will be warming up, it will go from the gun, and it will be a day where, you know, it's not long, but everyone will go into the red. There's no room for caution there, and I think that's a really interesting, I mean, one to sit down and watch from start to finish.
I mean, we heard from Chris Froome at the start of this segment, and, you know, the interesting thing about Froome, the way he's approached Grand Tours, has been how much he has, you know, worked on the areas that he would need. So looking at this, he will be working presumably on these sort of intense efforts, climbs, etc. And I think the surprise in this route is how little time trialing there was, because I think there's a sense that the Tour would like Tom Dumoulin is quite an attractive new star in the world of cycling, but on the other hand, the French hopefuls at the moment, the great French riders at the moment, are not time trialists. They're good climbers. Romain Bardet, Warren Barguil, Thibaut Pinot, decent time trialists. But it's a difficult one. It's a bit of a dilemma for them, that, isn't it? Do they design a route that would suit a Dumoulin? They might do that next year. Or one that favours the French riders. The thing about Froome, as he said, is he's an all-rounder. He can adapt to either.
Well, I think from their point of view, you say it's difficult, Richard. I actually think it's quite easy, because the biggest priority that they probably have, one would imagine, would be having another French winner. 1985 was the last occasion when a French man won the Tour de France, Hino, of course. And it's difficult to conceive of a route based on this year anyway, where Romain Bardet is going to be at an obvious advantage over Chris Froome. But I think this is as good as he'll get, particularly if we look at the final time trial, 31 kilometres, and it's pretty much a mountain stage. 31 kilometres, not just one very hard climb, but several steep hills, and it's a real, well, a specialist route, but not a specialist time trialist route, it's a specialist climber's route.
I wouldn't rule out Dumoulin though. I mean, Bergen was quite a hilly time trial. Dumoulin took over a minute out of Froome there, and I think his team won the team time trial as well. I think they'll be very competitive in that. He should be good on the cobbles as well. We saw the Binkbank Tour how much of an all-rounder he is too, so I think Dumoulin still might be a real threat.
Yeah, I think the big question mark for me in Dumoulin is that the level of concentration and the level of consistency over the 3 weeks, the level of consistency for his team as well. And you never know when. I mean, we've talked quite a bit this year about how often nowadays, with so many riders competing for not just the victory in Grand Tours, but just high placings, and so desperate to achieve those high placings that riders can use other teams quite a lot, but you can't count on that, can you? You never know when your team is going to be vital, so you do need to go in with as strong a team as possible. And you know, you look at the, paradoxically, a stage like that, very short one, the 65 kilometer stage, the team might be more vital there than ever, because attacks will come early, and actually leaders might get isolated pretty early. So Sunweb haven't really reinforced a great deal in the mountains, I don't think. I think I'm right in saying, in terms of the riders they've recruited for next year, they weren't terribly strong in the Giro this year. So that is a question mark from my point of view. And, you know, just how he deals with that first week, there's no doubt that there'll be two, three, four riders who lose the Tour that week.
Yeah, it strikes me, it's a bit like a Tour de France modelled on the Vuelta, isn't it? There's not many opportunities to have an easy day. And there are things that unsettle the rhythm. Rich, you talked about the transitional stages, the ones that go across to the middle of France from the Alps to the Pyrenees. And they're the kind of days where everyone has to be switched on, because there's something could happen. It probably won't, but they're the ones that mentally and physically wear people down. And then even in the Pyrenees, it's kind of it's not a block of stages. The one to Po kind of breaks the rhythm a little bit before then the one that goes over the Aspin, the Tourmalet, and the Aubisque. It's challenging mentally as well as physically. And looking at it on paper, there's nothing to necessarily wait for. It's not like the Giro that Dumoulin has just won, where the time trial at the end, he could be really confident. He could calculate how much time can I leave myself to try and make up on the last day. That time trial down in the very southwest corner of France, still in the Pyrenees, really, isn't it? That is going to be unpredictable. It's not one where anyone can go in and go, well, even Chris Froome, I can take 40 seconds here, or I can take a minute here, and it will be okay.
They could probably say that, but no more. They could probably say a minute, but if you look at the amount of climbing there is in the rest of the race, there's more than enough terrain for a Quintana or a Bardet or a Pinot to not be faced by that, not be daunted by having to go into that time trial a minute ahead of Froome. It's a climbing competition this year's, next year's Tour, really.
Yeah, but the prospect of the presence of Dumoulin just changes things interestingly, whereby if the focus is on Dumoulin and Froome, and both of them are thinking about that time trial, then perhaps there's an opportunity for somebody else to take advantage of that. I mean, Froome, as he said earlier, does base his race on his opponents, and having to focus on different types of opponents next year could be an interesting scenario. I think another thing, speculating about the course is one thing. It's even more of a fool's game to speculate about the weather, but we do spend a lot of time in northern France next year, almost half the race really, and that Froome does not he likes the heat, and you, around Brittany especially, you can get some pretty bad weather. Equally, it could be baking sunshine, you just don't know, but it can be nasty. And in 2014, when Froome crashed and then was out, it was maybe no coincidence that it was bad weather as well. It doesn't suit him, he doesn't like it, and we even saw that at the Vuelta this year too.
Taking speculation to new heights.
I know.
Even the Met Office doesn't try and predict the weather in 9 months' time.
I know. It might be lovely. But if the weather does become a factor, I'm definitely gonna dig out this part of this podcast and play it again in our Tour de France coverage next year. That is absolutely guaranteed.
And if it's hot and sunny, you can call me Radish Face again, can't you, Rich, when I catch the sun?
Well, yeah. anyway, we should wrap things up there, because Daniel's got to go and catch a train back to Berlin.
Extraordinary
back
stuff.
To Berlin, yeah. A quick thank you to James Phippen, who you will find on Twitter at Graphivelo, GraphiVelo. He sent us some lovely prints featuring some of the Tour de France mountains and the riders, some legends of the Tour. I've got your copies of those at the moment, Daniel and Lyle, but you will get them. But they're very nice. They're in my office at the moment and really brightening the place up. So thank you, James, for those. I say at Graphivelo, very, very gratefully received that gift. Thank you. So, as I say, the details of our show on the 20th of November will be announced very soon. Listen to the Cycling Podcast Femina, which is out at the moment, and more friend specials to come at thecyclingpodcast.com.
And we got through the whole podcast without me mentioning Watford's 2-1 win over Daniel's
until now. Until now.
Wonderful stuff.
Okay.
The best to last.
Let's wind up, Rich.
All right. Daniel, bon voyage. Safe home.
Thank you.
Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.